From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And in California, at least 16 fires are raging. In Los Angeles, evacuation orders are in place for some 20,000 residents as crews get control of the Getty Fire, which ignited yesterday near a major freeway. But the situation is much worse in Northern California, where the Kincaid Fire in Sonoma County has engulfed more than 74,000 acres. To put that in perspective, that's about twice the size of the city of San Francisco. For the latest, we have with us KQED reporter Alex Emsley. And Alex, this story is really developing so quickly. We just heard from firefighters today. What information did they share?
Today is about preparing for, I think, the worst. And the worst is coming this afternoon into the night. And that's a return of these offshore winds. It's not going to be quite as strong as what we saw over last weekend, which was hurricane force at points. Mm. But just because the wind isn't hurricane force doesn't mean it isn't a danger for this massive fire that could continue to threaten towns along the Highway 101 corridor north of the Bay Area. That's where firefighters have been making their stands for, you know, a couple of days now. And today is where the fire is expected to kind of ramp up in strength.
We've also been hearing about these red flag warnings that have been issued for most of Northern California and parts of Southern California. Can you talk about what these red flag warnings mean and how severe do they expect the conditions to get? You mentioned those high winds.
Yeah, and I think that the winds are just one kind of ingredient of a red flag warning. It can translate to, you know, an extremely high fire danger. Other things that could be a part of that are low relative humidity, dry fuels, high winds. You know, it's a recipe that the fire is likely to grow.
Then there are these planned blackouts, which are extensive. What's the latest there? And are they expected to continue throughout the week?
Well, it's a little bit mysterious. They started over the weekend in areas north of San Francisco. They were supposed to come back online yesterday, but that takes time, too. So it's relatively quick to shut the power down. But then they have to inspect all the lines and make sure that no trees blew into them or no other power poles blew over while they were de-energized. And so that was taking longer than folks were hoping yesterday when we had this kind of break in high winds and power could get turned back on. Now the winds are coming back later today, and I'm looking at a map of potential power shutoffs, and it basically starts a little ways south of San Francisco, goes almost all the way up the coast to the border with Oregon, and then a similar kind of spine on the interior of the state on the western side of the Sierras, also going almost up to the Oregon border. You know, with the last shutoff, it was estimated, you know, nearly a million people had lost power and had lost power for a while.
The California Public Utilities Commission announced it's going to launch an investigation into these blackouts. Tell us more about that.
The California Public Utilities Commission is a regulator of electricity companies, public utilities in California, obviously. And they have a tricky relationship with large utilities like PG&E that have been, to a degree, responsible for some major disasters in the state in recent years. So the CPUC needs to do something, and there has been some frustration over the power shutoffs. Are they too, you know, too widespread? Are they not planned for properly, you know, causing more havoc than they necessarily could? That's what I understand regulators are going to look into.
And PG&E is now saying that up to 500,000 people could potentially have their power shut off as they continue with the efforts that you mentioned. It's really hard to wrap your head around all of this. Spokesman Jonathan Cox said yesterday that it could take weeks, if not months, to fully extinguish these fires. Have you been able to talk with those impacted, and what are they telling you?
I can tell you that there are some differences in the way that the public and first responders have reacted to this fire in particular. There was more warning than maybe some of the previous large fires. People who live in these areas for the most part, from what I can tell, they heeded evacuation warnings. They got out as quickly as they could. There was enough time for that to happen. And so the number of people displaced, I think, has gone down a little bit. It's down to around 150,000 people, close to 200,000. And it could go up again. People tentatively being let back into their homes, and that could change, and they could be, told to evacuate again. If these winds do, you know, the worst case scenario, it has been majorly impactful to this region of California. And I feel like also, you know, the whole state and might I say surrounding states. I heard yesterday that 10 states in the West had sent firefighters to help on the Kincade fire in north of the Bay Area in California.
A massive undertaking, absolutely. And all the help is needed, I can imagine. That's Alex Emsley of KQED with the latest on the devastating wildfires in California. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Well, in Washington today, the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry continues with testimony from the first current White House official to go behind closed doors and questions from both Democrats and Republicans. And Alexander Vindman, top Ukraine expert at the National Security Council, listened in on President Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president, during which a transcript shows Trump asked Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden and the beginning of the Russia investigation. Vindman says in his opening statement he was concerned about the phone call and flagged it to NSC lawyers because he didn't think it was proper. Also today, House members are preparing for a vote this Thursday to authorize the impeachment inquiry. Republicans have claimed that House Democrats have been violating precedent and tradition by not holding that vote. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And it's been widely reported Nancy Pelosi didn't want an impeachment inquiry vote because Democrats in redder districts would then have to go on the record, and that's why Republicans wanted the vote. But, you know, they've also been saying, Republicans have, that there's no precedent for not having a vote. Is there?
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that requires a vote. There was a vote both with Presidents Nixon and Clinton. That's true. That's a tradition. But that was a choice, and that's a small case. There wasn't with Andrew Johnson in the 19th century. So Republicans are saying that, but it's not based on much of a foundation. Yeah. The House has incredible latitude in terms of how to conduct this kind of process.
So no constitutional roadmap, but an historical one that there was some precedent. But what does holding a vote this Thursday allow Democrats who are, you know, behind this inquiry to do more than they've already been doing?
Well, politically, it's simply a statement that there is a process. They are responding now to this Republican criticism. And so it gives the party some cover from this argument that they're just all over the place and they're handling the process in the way they want. It also is a way to collect Democratic support behind this. It will put pressure on those swing district Democrats. But what Pelosi can do is show, I have the votes of the majority behind continuing with this. Yeah. And I think that's really important.
Well, what about criticisms that the depositions in the inquiry that's already, that, you know, been going on have been closed door? You know, we saw the Republicans barge in. Democrats say that there will be public hearings with the same witnesses down the road, that this is the process. It's like a grand jury. And they do it so that witnesses can't coordinate their stories. Is that true?
Well, the fact is the Nixon and the Clinton impeachment had closed-door proceedings. The judiciary in both cases didn't do everything in front of the public. So that simply goes against not only the record, but what many Republicans who are currently in Congress were fine with back when Clinton was president. So there will be a public inquiry in the next stage. But this is totally not only within constitutional rules, but also within tradition.
And we should say also that both Republicans and Democrats have had the same amount of time, we understand 50% each, to question the witnesses behind those closed doors. You know, what do you think in general, Julian, about this period in history? You mentioned Nixon and Clinton, you're not going back that far. Is this the impeachment period in American history?
Well, if we compare where we are today compared to pre-1974, certainly impeachment is a more normal tool of politics, and we're willing to use that at some level when the case presents itself. It's still, I think, a very difficult process. I don't think politicians are eager to jump into this. Even in this case, Speaker Pelosi really, really has hesitated. But it is the fear is that if legislators are more comfortable using this, and we are in a more partisan era where partisan politics is fiercer, that we might see this again in the near future. But I still think politicians don't want to get into this too quickly.
In the minute we have, just a little more on that history, because it sounds like you were saying that this almost wasn't meant to be as big a deal as it has become. It was kind of a way to tack the ship, you know, tack the sails on the ship.
It's a last resort. It's when we have a situation where we can't just wait for the next election. And we wanted to prevent the country from suffering under presidential corruption or an abuse of presidential power. But just because it's not meant to be used very frequently doesn't mean it's not meant to be used. It was put in there for a reason, and many think we face that right now.
And I remember Alexander Hamilton's words, it's to keep foreigners from being in our affairs. Julian Zelitzer of Princeton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
And a story now about how people sell their guns. 21 states and the District of Columbia require background checks on at least some private gun sales. Still, each year, millions of private gun transactions are completed with no background check requirement. And there's almost no data on how often those guns end up in the wrong hands. But some private sellers do try to be careful about who they sell to. From Georgia, WABE's Lisa Hagen reports.
So this is the pistol here. This is a SIG P229 E2 model. It's a what they call a double action, single action, which means...
John Pander's a retired guy in his 50s who's pretty into guns. We're in a parking lot in Fayetteville, Georgia, outside a competitive shooting match he's headed into.
How much were you trying to sell this for?
I think like $750.
He usually buys his guns new from a licensed dealer. And Pander is a model responsible gun owner. He keeps them locked up in a safe at home. But sometimes the safe fills up.
So it all comes down to space. And yeah, sometimes you want to fund the next purchase.
So when he's got his eye on a new gun, he puts an old one up for sale online. He uses ArmsList, which is like a Craigslist for guns. He sold about 5 guns over the last decade this way. No problems.
I always meet in a public place, mostly Walmart. Parking lots are good. Some people say the police stations or sheriff offices are already a good place to do the transactions.
But recently...
It was late in the evening when I finally got the email. And he says, well, I'm trying to buy a gun for my girlfriend. You know, can we meet at 11 o'clock at this place? And first red flag, you know, for me is late at night.
Pander asked the guy if he has a Georgia weapons license, which would mean he's passed a background check in the past 5 years. And by asking that, he's going above and beyond his legal obligation. Because when it comes to private sales, federal law says you cannot knowingly sell a gun to someone who's prohibited from having one. Turns out, the guy doesn't have a license. So Pander says, what about meeting at a federally licensed dealer to run a background check? Costs about $25. The guy doesn't want to do that.
So at that point, you know, I'm not going to sell him anything.
Again, Pander could have sold that gun without asking questions. That would not have been breaking the law. Researchers think millions of gun transactions take place without a background check every year. Duke University economist Phil Cook has studied how guns make their way from the legal market to the criminal world.
What we know about is quite a bit about where offenders get their guns. And also, we can find out something about the first transaction that that gun was involved in.
That information comes from trace data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and from anonymous surveys of gun owners and convicted offenders. But there's little data on the exchanges that might happen between a legal purchase and an arrest. Cook has surveyed inmates in Chicago prisons. Almost all say they got their guns through friends, family, their social connections.
But it is very rare indeed to say that they made the transaction through the internet.
So do we know who does buy their guns this way and whether or not they could pass background checks?
And the answer, unfortunately, is no.
Deb Azriel directs research at the Harvard Injury Control Research Center.
But it's also reasonable to suspect that one reason that you go to a private seller and get a gun without a background check is because you think you couldn't pass that background check.
Azriel believes prohibited buyers are probably not the majority of people using sites like ArmsList, but she doesn't think they're a group we should ignore. Many gun rights advocates don't want a system that would record all private transfers. If it existed, they argue, the government could come take people's guns away. Georgia, where John Pander lives, is one of 29 states which don't require background checks or gun permits. And he's not comfortable supporting the idea of universal background checks, but he tries to be careful anyway. Here's why.
What happens if he would have used that in a crime? Then, you know, would that guilt be in my conscience if I went and saw, oh, that's the guy I just sold that gun to? So I don't want to be any part of that.
That guy who tried to buy his gun, he's not Pander's problem anymore. It's possible he kept looking for another pistol and someone willing to sell it to him in a parking lot late at night. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Hagen.
And Lisa's story comes to us from the public media project, Guns in America.
That is hit into left center field, back at the wall, it is gone. Yordan Alvarez back in the lineup for the Astros, and he goes deep.
Sound from Sunday night's World Series match. Game 6 is set for 8 p.m. East Coast time tonight. The Washington Nationals trying to climb back after losing 3 straight to the Houston Astros. The series now at 3-2. What a nail biter. But will tonight also be, for someone, the best game ever? Meaning maybe they'll meet their future mate or bond with a parent, or maybe put on their best frilly Sunday dress as their dad takes them down to the field where they patiently wait to finally meet the loves of their life, Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris. Wait, that was me. A foggy memory, but best game ever. Eric Gray has collected best game ever stories from around the world, actually. His book is called Bases to Bleachers. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Eric, hi.
Hi, Robin. What a pleasure and an honor.
Well, it's such a fun thing when you page through. I mean, there's Lou Harris from San Mateo, California, his game at Wrigley Field in 1953. When he walked in, he realized that games were in color and not black and white. As a little kid, he'd only seen them on TV. Here's an entry from Sheldon Green in Cleveland, Ohio. It was 1961, the Indians hosting Cleveland Hebrew Schools Day. The Indians' only Jewish player, Barry Lattman, is pitching, and Sheldon Green's rabbi summoned him over and blessed him. I mean, that meant a lot to him
it did.
In that moment. What about you? You know, you have a story about taking your kids to their first game.
Correct. I came out to San Francisco. Rachel was 8 and David was 4. I mean, Rachel brought an entire library with her because she knew how bored she would be. And by the third inning or so, David and his friend were completely done with the game, although they amused themselves by running up and down the stairs. And I would periodically look at Rachel. Her eyes were transfixed on the field as if she had just seen the Mona Lisa or the Beatles in concert right there at Candlestick Park 26 years, I think, to the day after. And since she's been 15, she's worked in guest services for the Giants.
Yeah. There's so many. There are very emotional stories here. One about the ball dude. It's his job to gather up foul balls. This is Gary Fralick, Stockton, California. One time he really wanted to get a ball that he could give to a young woman he saw in the stands.
He finally got a ball and he motioned her down. And as she was coming down, he realized that she had Down syndrome and he gave her the ball. And he said he'd never seen anybody react with so much excitement. And she goes back to her parents and her mom and her grandma are crying and her father is pointing at him and saying, "You're the man." And the essence of Gary's story was, they think I did so much for them. I was just doing my job. What they did for me can't be measured. And Gary and I are now friends.
Yeah. You have been traveling the country with your book and talking to people. How do people respond?
This book originally was going to be about famous games, a Mickey Mantle 500th home run, a Koufax no-hitter. But when the stories kept coming in, I realized that there was something far greater than this play of game event. They come up to me sometimes with glazed eyes, said, I had no idea. The stories most of all make you remember. The number of times people have said, you have made me think about these stories from my childhood, and they're not all happy. Someone that I know from upstate Washington, his name is Sean, he tells me the story about going to game with his son. His son was 17 years old, and they talked about girls and what his son Joe would be like as a father when he's growing up, and I let him have a sip of my beer, and he made believe he'd never tasted beer before, and I laughed. And he said that was the last game I ever went to with my son before he enlisted in the Marines and went to Afghanistan. Mm. And in fact, it was the last time he ever saw his son because his son, he was killed in Afghanistan. And whenever somebody writes in their emails to me, and most of the stories have been collected by email, they say, thank you for giving me a chance to, you know, relive this story. I always eliminate that from the story because it's not about me. But I wanted to keep that in Sean's story because I wanted to say, you're thanking me. Are you kidding me? Thank you for giving me the chance to not only hear that story, but to share it with people.
What do you think it is? You know, a guy who kept the wrapper on a cupcake because the cupcake was given out at a game for some strange reason. He kept the wrapper for years. What do you think it is about baseball that people have these memories?
I think there's something about baseball that really conveys that generation to generation thing. I like basketball. I'm not a big football fan, but I can't sit and tell you a million stories of my time at a basketball game. There's something about baseball, you know, something just enchanting about the national pastime. I had found out a few years ago that how important baseball was to the Japanese-American community. And I have a story from a woman, Japanese-American woman, who played baseball in the internment camps. Oh. And, you know, how that helped normalize, to the degree that that can be normalized, right, their lives. I got a story from a woman who was in the baseball league that a league of their own was based on.
Huh.
And, you know, I'm just so incredibly lucky to have these amazing stories.
Yeah. Well, I know you're continuing to collect stories. Can I tell you one last one? Because you and I have talked about this, right? So it's a Red Sox game, Fenway Park, on Patriots Day, which is the same day as the running of the Boston Marathon. And it started to be like a drumbeat rumor throughout the stadium that Bill Rogers, Boston's own, was going to win the Boston Marathon. I said, I got to go. I'm going to ditch this game. And I started running towards the finish line. And I heard this noise behind me, kind of a crackling on the ground. And I turn around, and it was Red Sox pitcher Bill Lee in full uniform, including cleats, running behind me to the Elliott Lounge to see his friend Bill Rogers cross. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm following you. Let's go.
Bill Spaceman Lee.
Yeah. Send your stories to us at hereandnow.org. Eric Gray, again, the book is Bases to Bleachers, a collection of personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Juul, the e-cigarette maker, rode the wave of vaping's popularity. It's also been blamed for an increase in vaping among teens. The FTC and several state attorneys general are investigating the company's marketing practices as health concerns rise. Well, now Juul is announcing it will lay off about 500 employees by the end of this year. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
So a company that went from hiring 300 employees a month.
Yeah.
To now laying off maybe 10 to 15% of its workforce. Are you surprised?
Well, not after September, right? This was going to be a banner year for Juul, a company that seemed to have figured out that this is the hottest craze, this vaping. But in April, there was an investigation by the Food and Drug Administration about underage sales of these vaping products. So the FDA sent a letter to Juul requesting some documents. That would have been the beginning of seeing that there was a problem. And then there was a ban on flavored e-cigarettes in September. Now, that's been pulled back a little bit. The ban on flavors has been pulled back, but the FDA or the CDC had warned people not to use these vaping devices because of some illnesses that were spiking. So all of that has led to where we are right now. It is notable that 35% of the company is owned by the tobacco giant Altria, which used to be Philip Morris, and the company is worth over $30 billion.
So, you know, a lot at stake there. But, you know, there was a point when Juul was looking to ramp up marketing overseas.
Yes.
To make up for lower sales in the U.S. I mean, it's shades of the tobacco industry.
Exactly. Yeah. This is exactly the model that was used. So the FDA criticized Juul after it said that it had nothing to do with young people smoking or using e-cigarettes, but the use of e-cigarettes amongst young people skyrocketed about 78%. So when you think about cigarettes, that was what the big cigarette settlement was about. It was marketing to young people. Mm-hmm. So Juul then, in September of this year, named a brand new CEO, and they said, we're not selling any more flavored these e-cigarettes. We're going to just use tobacco flavor. But the bottom line is that is hurting their bottom line in terms of sales. So that's why they're concentrating on looking overseas.
And we want to be really clear. Juul is under several federal investigations, but it's related to whether, you know, as you've been saying, it improperly targeted teens with those flavored e-cigs. This
is exactly
not
right.
About the bootleg, THC cannabis-related
which is what
deaths,
caused,
right?
Which is what is thought to have caused a lot of those illnesses. So, yes, that's correct. And what the Centers for Disease Control has said is don't use these things to vape THC. So the totally disconnected things. The investigation into Juul is about marketing to young people.
And it's we see it's hitting the companies. At least its employees are going to be let go. And just in the minute we have, Ollie, we've got the Friday jobs, you know, to look forward to. And we're hearing that hiring is soft.
Yeah, hiring is soft. We have had relatively low unemployment consistently, but that actually happens when you've got such low unemployment because you've got so many, you have fewer workers available, so hiring does tend to slow down. The market is still strong, and we're still looking to see what the longer-term trend in unemployment is. We have seen less hiring in the past few months than we did, let's say, a year ago. So we're going to be watching this very closely to see whether it is a signal of an economic slowdown or just a signal of the fact that we've got very low unemployment.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
UNICEF recently shared what it calls a shocking statistic. Around the world, 1 in 3 children under 5 is either undernourished or overweight, and in some cases, they're both. The finding comes from the agency's 2019 report on the state of the world's children. In that report, the U.S. is among the countries struggling the most with childhood obesity, with 42% of kids ages 5 to 19 being overweight. Some say one glaring reason why is the lack of nutrition education. For an on-the-ground look at a community trying to find solutions, we're joined by Annie Streetmarter, founder of New Leaf Kitchen, a nonprofit that teaches kids, regardless of income, how to cook nutritious, affordable meals in the greater Cincinnati area. Annie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you've been working over the past year to provide nutrition education for young children through your nonprofit, New Leaf Kitchen. Tell us more about your community cooking program.
So our cooking and food education programs right now are mobile, and we go into any space or setting and teach any age and ability with our child-safe tools and allergy accommodations how to prepare simple, easy, many times raw and vegan food that they can access easily and that doesn't cost a fortune. So we're trying to teach this from the root up, and hopefully the children will then bring those ideas and passions and recipe cards home and then change what the parents are spending and buying from the grocery store and what we're demanding from the vendors and food manufacturers.
I can imagine, though, that can be a challenge because many low-income families often don't have the time. They may have multiple jobs where it really doesn't allow them to cook all the time. There's the cost of health food. how are you helping these students navigate what are real barriers?
Well, for instance, people have talked about cost being a huge barrier. We try to teach how buying in bulk, buying dried, frozen, raw forms of things versus processed, already made organic foods is more cost effective. Prioritizing your time so that instead of sitting and watching 20, 30 minutes of TV, you use that 20, 30 minutes to prepare pasta for the entire week of dinners. So the planning, the prioritizing, and the ability to be patient to realize the impact might not come instantly, but the impact will come later. And if you don't have the time to eat healthy now, are you going to have the time to be sick and take off work later? It's just the consequences far outweigh in terms of cost if you eat unhealthy than versus if you eat healthy.
Yeah, I'm really interested to know you're not a nutritionist or a pediatrician. How has your professional background, though, inspired this effort?
So I have a psychology degree. I've worked with many different capacities with children and families. I have always been a vegan, so I've had to study and do a lot of research on my own, which has been really eye-opening and sparked a lot of passions. And instead of being judgmental or resentful or demonizing food to people and preaching, I've just decided to find a solution. Mm-hmm. And the solution is to make healthy eating more positive.
Take me into one of your kitchens. You talk about sparking that love and passion for cooking. What kinds of foods do you cook with the kids? I'm reading here that some are as young as 18 months old.
Oh, yeah. We start young. They are never too young to start cooking. All of our tools are child safe and all of our information is age appropriate. So we try to include fun facts about how 90% of a cucumber is water, or, you know, tell them about how different foods grow and bring in the whole plant so they can see and feel the roots of the plant. If we're doing, for instance, mac and squash instead of mac and cheese, we'll bring in the whole squash and let them actually explore the seeds and get hands-on with the seeds. We have mashers, so they're mashing the squash up. We have juicers for them, so they're juicing the lemon juice. And then we're using nutritional yeast, which might be a luxury item perception for some, but it's not. It's an affordable item that adds a ton of nutrients to vegetarian meals that is a shelf-stable item, so will last for a long time, and you just need a little bit will go a long way. So we teach them about new foods like that that might have seemed inaccessible to them, but we tell them where to source it from and how it grows and what it can do for their bodies. So we, you know, their interest in these new foods and their excitement to try what they made really encourages us to keep on going because we hear things like, I didn't even know a carrot grew in the ground, or, you know, I've never tried a tomato before and I love tomatoes now. So we're definitely hearing that kids are taking what we're making in class and bringing it home. And we made oat milk instead of, you know, telling people you need to go buy plant-based milk because that's expensive. So we made granola balls, and then we showed them another way to use these inexpensive oats was to blend up water and oats and a couple raisins and a little bit of cinnamon. Blend it up and strain it through. You could do a strainer or a cheesecloth, and they loved squeezing that through. And they drank this creamy, delicious plant-based beverage that they all were so excited about. And this was at a library program in Cincinnati. And I got an email from a parent later saying that ever since then, oats have been on their grocery list and that they have made granola balls and oat milk has been in their fridge ever since.
Oh, so that's
the kind of impact that we want to have.
You know, when I was in third grade, I remember someone brought an eggplant and an artichoke and showed us how to cook it. And I never forgot that.
Yeah. You know, one more thing is we want to be able to utilize the whole plant. So we don't just stop at showing them how to make applesauce. We tell them that with that juice strained from steaming the apples, you can make an apple beverage. And with those peels that we made apple art and apple chips. And with any other scraps that we had left over, we told them about composting and how any appropriate foods would be fed to our chickens, which then produce more food.
Yeah, this all sounds so lovely. How would you recommend that other communities replicate your efforts? It's not cheap, I can imagine, to have this kind of program.
No, it's definitely not cheap. We definitely have relied a lot on individual contributions. We've gotten a couple big grants from a foundation out of Pittsburgh and a Connect Claremont grant. We've relied on some local fundraising efforts and our paid programming from our cooking programs and cooking clubs and preschools and elementary schools has given us some funding to be able to continue to write grants and look at the bigger picture to be able to put these lesson plans and these developed recipes up on the internet to reach more schools and to be up on the web for people to access whenever they need it.
This, on an individual level, on a community level, this is working for you all, but what would you recommend or what would be your call to action for policymakers to help be able to make this beyond a community effort, but something larger?
In terms of policy, I tend to shy away from wanting to change policy to put taxes on sugary foods or force people to eat certain foods. Instead, I would rather maybe give incentives definitely for grocery stores to buy local. But if the consumer is not buying that product off the shelf, the grocery store is not going to continue to shelve it. So we are trying to take a different approach to allow the consumer to change the policy by demanding better foods, by not purchasing the items that have harmful chemicals in them. But we have to teach that consumer how to read labels and what these ingredients mean and what they do to our bodies and why we need to avoid them and show them the power that food can have. And so if we do that, we feel like, yes, we hope that policymakers are like-minded people and we can change their minds as well to be more mindful thinkers when it comes to policies. But we would like to take a more rooted up approach and try to really get the consumers to change it just naturally.
Annie Streetmarter, she is founder of New Leaf Kitchen, a mobile community cooking nonprofit for kids in the greater Cincinnati area. Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
In London today, the British Parliament is voting again on whether to hold a general election in early December. They voted yesterday, but this time they might vote yes after the leader of the opposition Labour Party said he'd support it. It's the latest attempt by UK politicians to come to some conclusion on Brexit. Remember, we told you yesterday the EU just gave them another 3-month extension to figure out how to break up with Europe, straighten out questions like how to have trade and borders. Our Jeremy Hobson is at the BBC reporting from London all week. Jeremy, what's going on?
So as we talked about yesterday, Robin, the Prime Minister could not get his Brexit deal through Parliament by the deadline that he had set, which was supposed to be this Thursday. Mm-hmm. And so he said, okay, well, let's have an election and maybe we can get a mandate from the British people to actually make Brexit happen. The opposition Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn, was opposed to this. They said they wanted the idea of a no-deal crash-out Brexit to be off the table. And then these two smaller parties, the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, who want no Brexit at all, said that they would be in favor of having a December election, which put Labour in a very tough spot. They didn't want an election in part because the polls show that they wouldn't do very well in an election. So then today, this is all just happening, you know, hour by hour, Robin. Today, Jeremy Corbyn said that that demand about a no deal Brexit being off the table has been met because of that extension that the EU gave yesterday. So he said he is now ready to have an election and said his party should be on board, but they aren't all on board. And I spoke earlier today at Parliament with David Lammy, who is a Labour Party Member of Parliament.
So are you going to support your leader's call to have an election in December?
No, I won't be supporting a general election this year. I think that the way to deal with this problem is to deal with the issue of Brexit, and the best way to do that is to go back to the people in the form of a people's vote, a referendum. I also am very sad. I think that we are very close to having the votes for a second referendum. We defeated the government on its Queen's speech. We defeated Boris Johnson on his intention to put this bill down in the way he wanted to. And so I'm sad that really because of Scottish nationalists and they're putting their party interests first and Liberal Democrats putting their own party interests first in the general election that we've arrived at this point. But I'm sticking to my guns, and my guns have always been clear that the way to deal with this problem is a second referendum.
Why do you think that the parties you just mentioned, the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish National Party, decided just in the last few days to go ahead and support a December election?
Well, it's clear that in relation to Scotland, the Scottish Nationalist Party will do extremely well in a general election and will defeat Labour and Conservative colleagues. And it's also clear that Liberal Democrats see huge gains at the expense of Labour and the expense of Conservatives.
But not enough gains to actually take control or be a real opposition party.
In a first-past-the-post system, we're still left with the Conservatives or the Labour Party forming a government. Obviously, I will be fighting for a Labour government, and I will be reminding people that the best way to defeat Brexit is to vote for Labour, which is pledged to having that referendum. But I am still sad that we've arrived in this position, and that effectively we're going to the polls in December. Snow might be on the ground. It will be hard for the elderly to get to the polls. A lot of working people will find it hard. Very, very dark, challenging for the disabled. It's a very curious time to have a general election.
So you think it's going to backfire on Labour?
Well, no. I mean, I've been around in politics for a very long time to say that, you know, I'm not going to call a general election result for a number of reasons. One, you know, a week's a long time in politics, and a day is a long time in politics at the moment in this country. And of course, we'll be campaigning. The election will begin as a Brexit election, but of course, it will move on to other subjects through the course of those 4 or 5 weeks. And I think also that whilst it is absolutely clear at the moment that Labour are trailing in the polls, actually, Boris Johnson is doing less well in the polls than the Theresa May was doing at the point at which she called it an election. You'll remember that the result was very close. So I think the result will be very close yet again in this election.
So in other words, Robin, nobody knows what is going to happen. Now, there's another wrinkle here, which is that as members of parliament go to vote tonight, some of the opposition parties want to amend the bill to say that 16 and 17-year-olds should be able to vote, and so should EU citizens who are residents of the UK. And Boris Johnson's government is saying tonight that if those things pass, the bill is dead.
But I just want to make sure, Jeremy, briefly, the takeaway, I'm hearing that Remainers, people who don't want Brexit, the thinking is that they will not win an election, that the Brexiteers, like your dear grandmother, people who want a break, the Remainers...
Yes.
See,
no, you're right. The Remainers look at the polls right now and say it doesn't look good for us. But as David Lammy was saying, nobody really can tell what is going to happen. By the way, Robin, we are calling our coverage this week because you have to come up with a name for everything now.
Yeah.
We're calling it Should I Stay or Should I Go? So I leave you with that.
You should have just called it The Clash. Jeremy Hobson with The Clash. We'll have more Brexit from the BBC all week. Jeremy, thank you.
Should I stay or should I go?
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go?